This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, November 15th, 2011. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the virus mutant in our veins. Edgar Bowers may not be as well known as some other American poets who also served in World War II, Randall Jarrell, Anthony Hecht, and Kenneth Koch, to name just a few. I hadn't heard of him at all until very recently, when the poet Joshua Meegan mentioned him to me as someone he thought was vastly underappreciated. Josh knew Edgar Bowers toward the end of Bowers' life, and he deeply admires his poetry. So I asked Josh to choose an Edgar Bowers poem for this podcast and to guide us through it. We decided on a fairly long one for Louis Pasteur, the title poem of the book Bowers published in 1989. We have a recording of Bowers reading it at the Sewanee Writers Conference in 1999, less than a year before he died.
The poem has an epigraph, and the epigraph is, "Who is Apollo? College student."
Josh, so why does he have that epigraph, "Who is Apollo?" Is he appalled that a student would not know who Apollo was?
Yeah, on some level. I mean, it's kind of a dry joke, but yeah, I think he probably was pretty appalled. I think as a teacher, he saw lots of that.
That being ignorance of the basic historical and cultural facts of the Western tradition. And for Bowers, that ignorance is a big problem if we have any hope of understanding ourselves. The first sentence of the poem spells this out clearly.
How shall a generation know its story if it will know no other?
And the other story Bowers tells in his poem, for his generation to understand itself, is that of Louis Pasteur. Pasteur, of course, was the great 19th century French scientist famous for creating vaccines for rabies and anthrax, for pasteurization, for explaining how germs on the hands of doctors could lead to childbed fever, and that's just the short list of his achievements. The poem is in very supple blank verse. Let's listen to the first stanza.
How shall a generation know its story if it will know no other? When, among the scoffers at the Institute, Pasteur heard one deny the cause of childbirth fever. Indignantly, he drew upon the blackboard, for all to see, the streptococcus chain. His mind was like Odysseus and Plato, exploring a new cosmos in the old as if he wrote a poem. His enemy, suffering, disease, and death. The battleground is introspection. Science and peace, he said, will win out over ignorance and war. But then the virus mutant in his vein, death to the Prussian, and revenge, revenge.
Death to the Prussian and revenge, revenge. That seems to come out of nowhere. What's he talking about there?
This is taken from a letter. Pasteur was a very patriotic man, at times during the Franco-Prussian War, hysterically nationalistic, and he wrote in this letter that I'm referring to that he was going to begin every scientific article that he published with an epigraph saying, "Hatred to Prussians and revenge, revenge, or death to the Prussians and revenge, revenge."
Because at that time, Prussia was at war with France and Napoleon III.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. That helps set up the next long stanza, which shifts suddenly to World War II, and how that war marked Bowers' generation.
How shall my generation tell its story? Their fathers jobless, boys for the CCC and NYA, the future like a stairwell to floors without a window or a door. And then the army, bayonet drill and foxhole, bombing to rubble cities with textbook names later to bulldoze streets for. Their green bodies drowned in the greener surfs of rumored France. My childhood friend, George Humphreys, whom I still see, still 10 years old, his uncombed hair and grin, moment by moment in the Hurtgen dark, until the one step, full in the sniper's sight, his pastor father emptied by the grief. Clark Harrison, at 19, a survivor, never to walk or have a child or be a senator or governor. Herr Wegener, who led his little troop, their standard high and sabers drawn against a panzer corps, emerging from the shades at Dachau, stacked like firewood for someone else to burn. And Gert Radomski, listening to broadcasts of names, a year-long babble of the missing, to find his wife and children. Then they came home, near middle age at 22, to find a new reunion of the church and state. Cynical Constantines who need no name, domestic tranquility beaten to a sword, sons wasted by another lie in Asia, or strange loves they had feared that August day. And they, like runners, stung behind a flag, running within a circle, bereft of joy.
That was the second of four stanzas in this poem, and it started out with Depression America.
Their fathers jobless, boys for the CCC and NYA.
The Civilian Conservation Corps and the National Youth Administration being federal jobs programs for unemployed young men in the 1930s. Then the poem movingly catalogs the war experiences of some of the members of his generation. And then...
Then they came home, near middle age at 22, to find a new reunion of the church and state. Cynical Constantines who need no name.
What does he mean by that, a new reunion of the church and state?
I think he's talking about the kind of religious and social conservatism, maybe a kind of unthinking attitude that was born after the war.
Mm. Cynical Constantines, meaning referring back to the Byzantine Emperor Constantine. Why cynical Constantines, though?
Cynical because Constantine promised, at least inwardly promised, that he would become a Christian, that he would convert to Christianity if he won a battle.
And then something very interesting happens. He talks about the 50s, basically.
Domestic tranquility beaten to a sword.
He's right, taken the old image of beating swords into plowshares, mm-hmm, and turning that on its head. What is he getting at there?
I suppose a super aggressive strain of malignant cheerfulness or something like that.
But it comes to a head in another war.
Sons wasted by another lie in Asia.
And I'm assuming that he's talking about Vietnam here.
I would assume so, yeah. He could also be talking about Korea.
Or strange loves they had feared that August day.
The only thing, when he says strange loves, I think of the Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr.
That's right,
Strange
Love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strange Love, you know, the hawkish person in control of nuclear weapons. The August day is August 6th, 1945, when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
And they, like runners, stung behind a flag, running within a circle, bereft of joy.
This is a reference to Dante. Dante has people who had been noncommittal chasing a flag, a banner for eternity, and being stung by wasps and hornets and so on. So in a way, this is a very damning criticism of his generation.
So then the poem shifts back to Pasteur's life. Help set this next bit up a little bit.
The culmination of the Franco-Prussian War, Napoleon III invaded and was captured, you know, the head of France was captured along with 100,000 or more soldiers. So it was an astonishing loss. And after that, the Prussians invaded France and besieged Paris. So that's the background here.
Hearing of the disaster at Sedan and the retreat, worse than the one from Moscow, their son among the missing or the dead, Pasteur and his wife, Mary, hired a carriage and traveling to the east where he might try his way to Paris, stopping to ask each youth and comfort every orphan of the state's irascibility, found him at last and unsurprised, embraced, and took him in. Two wars later, the Prussian, once again the son of Mars, in Paris, Joseph Meister, the first boy cured of rabies, now the keeper of Pastor's mausoleum, when commanded to open it for them, though over 70, lest he betray the master, took his life.
There's one thing that's very odd that happens there. When Pastor finds his son, which I imagine there's quite a rabble of people around him, he's unsurprised.
Yeah, throughout the poem, there are hints at something unreasonable in Pasteur, and this might be a view of the connection between the things that are reasonable and the things that are unreasonable in his nature. You know, he's unsurprised in the same way he'd be unsurprised that because he was driven to start trying to fight disease by the death of his children, that then he actually did develop vaccines for rabies and anthrax and started modern immunology. So unsurprised because he just kept at it until it happened.
But as readers, we're surprised that he's unsurprised to have found his son in the midst of all that. Then the narrative takes an incredible leap 2 wars later, going from the French-Prussian War from the 1870s to World War II.
Yeah.
And talking about Joseph Meister.
The first boy cured of rabies.
He was 9 years old in 1885. And Pasteur gave the kid the shots and the kid lived.
And was so grateful, apparently, that he became the keeper of Pasteur's mausoleum in Paris.
He was. And the story, as Edgar Bowers has it, is that when he was asked by the Nazis to let them into the tomb, he refused them and committed suicide. It may not have been quite that pat, but he did commit suicide, and part of the reason may have been that.
And there's a heroic action implied here, that he's defending the legacy of Pasteur in some way or another.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, in the face of this overwhelming, horrible force of the Nazis.
Yeah.
In spite of his suicide, he's a force kind of civilization standing up for values that he believes in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the poem shifts to the last stanza.
I like to think of Pasteur in Elysium, beneath the sunny palm of ripe Provence, tenderly raising black sheep, butterflies, silkworms, and a new culture for delight, teaching his daughter to use a microscope and musing through a wonder, sacred passion, practice, and metaphysic, all the same. And each year honored three births, Valéry, humbling his pride in order to write well, Mozart, who lives still, keeping my attention repeatedly outside the reach of pride, and him whose mark I witness as a trust. Others he saves, but could not save himself. Socrates, Galen, Hippocrates, the spirit fastened by love upon the human cross.
So that's the end of the poem, but let's talk a little bit about this last stanza, which is basically saying that he likes to think of Pasteur in the afterlife, an idealized Pasteur, in a heavenly Provence, raising sheep, silkworms,
and a new culture for delight, teaching his daughter to use a microscope and musing through a wonder, sacred passion, practice, and metaphysic, all the same.
And Bowers, or the speaker of the poem, also likes to honor three of his culture heroes on their birthdays. Paul Valéry, the French poet and mathematician.
Humbling his pride in order to write well.
Mozart.
Who lives still, keeping my attention repeatedly outside the reach of pride.
And Pasteur himself.
And him whose mark I witness as a trust. Others he saves, but could not save himself. Socrates, Galen, Hippocrates, the spirit fastened by love upon the human cross.
But what are we to make of the line saying Pasteur saves others but could not save himself? And what are Socrates and Galen and Hippocrates, two ancient physicians, doing there?
The way I read it is he couldn't save himself from the difficulties mentioned elsewhere in the poem, the anger, the desire for vengeance. And then Socrates, Galen, Hippocrates, they're just thrown in there, kind of. It's a very strange way of putting them in the poem.
Yeah.
But I think these are people who live their lives working for the same goals. They are really sort of the beginning, in a certain way, of the tradition that Pasteur joined.
And then the poem ends very provocatively. One could almost think that he was writing a religious poem here. The spirit fastened by love upon the human cross. And that is an image of Jesus Christ. But he's replacing Jesus Christ with Pasteur and Socrates, Galen, and Hippocrates.
Well, I think he's replacing it with the thing that they all have in common, which is reason and order, and also the scientific values of dispassionate inquiry. And in this poem, those are where we might expect to find mystical revelation of Christ, you know, on the cross.
So that is a it's not an anti-Christian poem. He's just saying this is as valuable to me as Christ is to the Christians.
I think so, yeah.
So what is he saying about those values that he cares about? They were flawed in Pasteur. They were very flawed in the World War II generation that he belonged to. What is he saying about those, the survival of those values?
We all might be imperfect. We all might become enraged. On the way here to the studio, I was in the car screaming at people. But that's not my best self. I would prefer to be other than that most of the time. Both parts are definitely there in everybody, not just in Pasteur, but if we can just be open-endedly engaged and make an effort and continue caring, these are heroic moments that fall on the side of
civilization.
Civilization, Apollonian, you know, humanism, idealism, and so on.
The recording of Edgar Bowers comes to us courtesy of the Sewanee Writers Conference. You can read more poems by Edgar Bowers on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also read poems and articles by Josh Megan. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.